Glasses are broken, and it slams loudly against the wall. Mr. Garrett glances up from his post behind the register, reading glasses perched on nose, pile of papers in his lap.
Well, hello, Samantha.
I didn't even change out of my uniform, which no one could call empowering and confidence-building. I feel completely embarrassed and remember the lock on the door and think, he knows. He knows. It shows completely.
He's out back, Mr. Garrett tells me mildly, unpacking shipments.
Then he returns to the papers. I feel compelled to explain myself. I just thought I'd come by before babysitting, you know, at your house, just to say hi. So I'm going to do that now. Jace is in back then? I'll just say hi. I'm so suave. I can hear the ripping sound of the box cutter before I even open the rear door to find Jace with a huge stack of cardboard boxes. His back's to me, and suddenly I'm as shy with him as I was with his father. This is silly. Brushing through my embarrassment, I walk up, put my hand on his shoulder. He straightens up with a wide grin.
Am I glad to see you?
Oh, really?
Really? I thought you were Dad telling me I was messing up again. I've been a disaster all day. Kept knocking things over. Paint cans or garden display. You finally sent me out here when I knocked over a ladder. I think I'm a little preoccupied.
Maybe you should have gotten more sleep, I offer.
No way, he says.
Then we just gaze at each other for a long moment. For some reason, I expect him to look different, the way I expected I would myself in the mirror this morning. I thought I would come across richer, fuller, as happy outside as I was inside, but the only thing that showed was my lips puffy from kisses. Jace is the same as ever, also. That was the best study session I ever had, I tell him.
Locked in my memory, too, he says, then glances away as though embarrassed, bending to tear open another box. Even though thinking about it made me hit my thumb with a hammer putting up a wall display.
This thumb? I reach for one of his calloused hands, kiss the thumb.
It was the left one.
Jace's face creases into a smile as I pick up his other hand.
I broke my collarbone once, he tells me, indicating which side. I kiss that. Also some ribs during a scrimmage freshman year.
I do not pull his shirt up to where his finger points now. I am not that bold. But I do lean in to kiss him through the soft material of his shirt. Feeling better? His eyes twinkle.
In eighth grade, I got into a fight with this kid who was picking on Duff, and he gave me a black eye.
My mouth moves to his right eye, then the left. He cups the back of my neck in his warm hands, settling me into the V of his legs, whispering into my ear.
I think there was a split lip involved, too.
Then we are just kissing, and everything else drops away. Mr. Garrett could come out at any moment. A truck full of supplies could drive right on up. A fleet of alien spaceships could darken the sky. I'm not sure I'd notice. We stand there, leaning back against the door, until a large truck really does pull in, and Jace has to unload more things. It's only 11:30, and I'm not due at the Garrett's till 3, so I don't want to leave, which means I busy myself doing unnecessary things, like rearranging the order of the sample chips in the paint section, listening to the click, click, click of Mr. Garrett's pen cap, and reliving everything in my happy heart. Later, I struggle to concentrate and help Duff build a humane zoo habitat for Arctic animals out of recyclable materials for his science camp exhibit. The task is complicated by the fact that George and Harry keep eating the sugar cubes we're trying to use as building material. Also by the fact that Duff is unbelievably anal about what recyclable means.
I'm not sure sugar counts as recyclable, and definitely not pipe cleaners,
he says, glaring at me as I slap white paint on egg cartons, transforming them into icebergs, which are going to float in our fake aluminum foil Arctic waters. The kitchen door bursts open, and Andy storms through without explanation, in floods of tears, her wails echoing down the stairs.
I can't get these cubes to stay together. They keep melting when I put the glue on them,
Duff says crossly, swirling his paintbrush in the puddle of Elmer's, which has just dissolved another sugar cube. Maybe if we put clear fingernail polish on them, I suggest.
That'll melt too, Duff says gloomily.
We could just try, I offer. George, crunching, suggests we build the walls out of marshmallows instead.
I'm sort of sick of sugar cubes.
Duff reacts with rage out of all proportion.
George, I'm not building this as a snack for you. Marshmallows don't look anything like glass bricks in a wall. I need to do well on this. If I do, I get a ribbon, and next month's camp costs half off. Let's ask Dad, Harry suggests. Maybe boat shellac or something.
My life is over, Andy sobs from upstairs.
I think I should go talk to her, I tell the boys. You call your father or Jace. I head up the stairs toward the echoing wails, grabbing a box of Kleenex from the bathroom before I go into Andy and Alice's room. She's lying face down on her bed in her soggy bathing suit, having cried so hard that there's a big, damp circle on her pillow. I sit down next to her, handing her a wad of Kleenex.
It's over. Everything's over.
Kyle? I ask, grimacing, because I know that's what it has to be.
He broke up with me.
Andy raises her head, her hazel eyes swimming with tears.
By post-it note. He stuck it on my life jacket while I was practicing rigging the jib.
You're kidding, I say, which I know is the wrong thing to say, but honestly. Andy reaches under the pillow and pulls out a neon orange square that reads, Andrea, it's been fun, but now I want to go with Jade Whalen. See ya, Kyle.
Suave.
I know.
Andy bursts into a fresh round of tears.
I've loved him for 3 years, ever since he taught me how to make a slipknot on the first day of sailing camp. And he can't even say this to my face. Sia, Jade Whalen, she used to take boys behind the piano in fourth grade assembly and show them her bra. She didn't even need one. I hate her. I hate him.
You should, I say. I'm sorry. I rub Andy's back in little circles, much the way I did Nan's. The first boy I kissed was this guy, Taylor Oliveira. He told everyone at school I didn't know what to do with my tongue. Andy gives a faint, watery giggle.
Did you?
I had no clue, but neither did Taylor. He used his like a toothbrush. Yuck! Maybe because his dad was a dentist. Andy giggles again, then looks down and sees the post-it note. The tears resume.
He was my first kiss. I waited for somebody I really cared about. And now it turns out he was a jerk. Now I can't take it back. I wasted my first kiss on a jerk.
She curls into a ball on the bed, sobbing even louder.
Shut up, Andy. I can't concentrate on my project. Duff calls up the stairs.
My world is coming to an end, she retorts loudly, so I don't particularly care.
At this point, Patsy wanders in, having recently learned both to climb out of her crib and to remove her diaper, in whatever state it may be. In this case, fully loaded. She waves it triumphantly at me.
Poop!
Ugh, Andy moans.
I'm gonna throw up.
I'll get it. I reflect on the fact that 2 months ago, I had never come in contact with a diaper. Now I could practically teach a learning annex course on the many ways of dealing with any potential toileting disaster. Patsy watches me with detached curiosity as I clean up her wall. Ew. Change her sheets. Again, ew. Plunk her into a short bath and re-diaper and clothe her in something sanitary.
We're poop,
she asks mournfully, craning her neck to examine her bottom.
George!
A furious voice bellows from the kitchen. I go down to find that George has used the hammer from his Bob the Builder toolkit to smash the remaining sugar cubes, while Duff was on the phone with his father. Now George, spindly legs flying, is running out the door, wearing nothing but Superman underpants, with Duff angrily brandishing the phone as though it's a weapon, careening after him. I chase them up the driveway just as the bug pulls in, and Jace climbs out, all loose-limbed Grace.
Hey now.
He reaches out to me. We stand in the driveway with Jace kissing me, as though the fact that Harry is making vomiting noises and Duff is about to kill George doesn't matter at all. Then he loops his arm around my neck, turns to his brothers and says,
"Okay, what's going on?"
In no time he has it all sorted out. Duff is painting popsicle sticks white to replace the crumbling sugar walls. Andy's eating a Milky Way and watching Ella Enchanted on the big bed in her parents' room. Pizza Palace is on its way. Harry's making a gigantic pillow house cage for Patsy and George, who are pretending to be baby tigers.
Now, Jace observes, before some or all of that falls apart again, come here.
He leans back against the counter, pulling me between his thighs and smoothing his hands up and down my back. It's all so good. My body is singing happy. My days are full of good moments. My life feels more right than it ever has been before. And that can be, I learn, how it happens. You're walking along on this path, dazzled by how perfect it is, how great you feel. And then, just a few forks in the road, and you are lost, in a place so bad you never could have imagined it. Chapter 36. When I clock out from the B&T the next day, I'm surprised to see the Jetta pulling into the parking lot and Tim beckoning to me from inside.
I need you,
he calls, pulling up illegally in the fire zone. What for? I ask, nonetheless climbing into the car, awkwardly pulling down my short skirt.
I bagged out on your mom. Well, mostly on Clay. I called and quit. Now I need to get my shit from the office and I need a shield. Hey, how much do you weigh? 110-pound shield.
112, I correct. I don't even think Clay's there. He and my mom were doing some factory thing. Tim knocks a Marlboro out of the pack stored in the sun visor, sticking it into the corner of his mouth.
I know his schedule.
He taps a finger against his temple.
Maybe I just need you along so I'll actually do this and not turn chicken shit at the last minute. Maybe I need you to give me a shove in and out the door. You gonna help me out?
I nod. Sure, but if you're looking for a shield, Jace is a lot bigger than I am.
Yeah, but Loverboy's busy today, as I'm sure you know.
I'm not about to admit that I do. Instead, I tug my hair out of its braid.
Man, you're such a babe.
Tim shakes his head.
Why do all the hot girls want the jocks and the good boys? We losers are the ones who need you.
I check his expression warily. I've never before had any impression Tim was attracted to me. Maybe my new non-virgin state shows. Maybe I radiate smoke and sex now. Somehow I doubt this, especially in my fetching crested lifeguard jacket and navy spandex skirt.
Don't stress.
Tim finally lights the dangling cigarette.
I don't want to be that lame guy who comes on to the girl he can't have. I'm just saying.
He makes a wide and illegal U-turn to go more quickly in the direction of Mom's local office.
Want to smoke?
He drops the Marlboros in my lap. I don't. You know that, Tim.
What do you do with your time, with your hands? That's the thing I can't figure out.
Tim takes one hand off the wheel and shakes it at me vigorously, as though he has an uncontrollable twitch.
What do you hold on to?
I feel my face heat. Tim smirks at me.
Oh, right, I forgot. Besides Loverboy and his...
I hold up my hand in a stop motion, changing the subject before he can finish his sentence. Is it still hard, Tim, not drinking and stuff? It's been, what, a month?
33 days, not that I'm counting. And yeah, of course it's freaking hard. Things only come easy to people like you and Mr. Perfect. For me, it's like every day, a million times a day. I want to get back together with that scorching girl, a.k.a. the quart of Bacardi or the bag of Coke or whatever, even though I know she's only going to screw me over again.
Tim, You've got to get over this everything's easy for everyone else stuff. It's not true, and it makes you boring. Tim whistles.
Channeling Jace, are you?
I shake my head. No. It's just watching you and Nan. I trail off. Is there any point to telling him I know he used her work? What does it matter now? He got expelled. Nan got the awards.
Watching Nan do what?
Tim asks, picking up on the way my voice wobbles when I say her name. He tosses the butt of the first cigarette out the window, reaching for another. I hedge. She's so stressed out, this summer already, about colleges.
Yeah, well, we Masons do obsession and compulsion well.
Tim snorts.
I generally stick to compulsion and let Nano handle the obsession, but sometimes we swap. I love my sister, but there's no rest for either of us. I'm always there to provide her with an object lesson of how much it sucks to screw up, and she's always there to remind me how miserable she is looking perfect. And speaking of miserable, here we are.
He wheels into the parking lot by Mom's office. Even though Mom's schedule is jam-packed, I'm somehow still surprised to find the offices full of people in assembly lines folding pamphlets, putting them in envelopes and putting on labels and stamps. People really believe in her, enough to sit in stuffy offices doing boring tasks during the most beautiful days of Connecticut's all-too-short summer. As we walk in, two older women at a big central table look up and give Tim broad, motherly smiles.
"We heard a rumor you were quitting on us, but we knew that couldn't be true," the taller, thinner one says. "Grab a chair, Timothy, dear."
Tim puts his arm around her bony shoulder.
"Sorry, Dottie. The rumor is reality. I'm leaving to spend more time with my family."
He says the last in his movie phone voice.
"And this is?"
The other woman squints at me.
"Ah, the senator's daughter."
She cuts her eyes to him.
"And your girlfriend? She's very pretty."
"No, alas, she belongs to another, Dottie. I just pine for her from afar."
He starts cramming papers, and I notice office supplies into his backpack. I roam around the office picking up brochures and buttons advertising Mom, then putting them back down. Finally, I wander into her quiet office. Mom likes her comforts. Her office chair is top-of-the-line ergonomic, fine leather. The desk is no gray metal one from office supply, but a rich carved oak antique. There's a vase of red roses and a picture of Mom with me and Tracy in matching satin and velvet Christmas outfits. There's also a big basket of gardening tools, gift-wrapped in shiny green cellophane, with a note saying, "We at Riggio's Quality Lawns are grateful for your support." A couple of tickets to a Broadway show, thumbtacked to the corkboard, allow us to treat you to some quality entertainment in thanks for all you do, from some people named Bob and Marge Considine. A business card saying, "Thanks for giving our bid serious consideration," from Carlisle Contracting. I don't know campaign rules, but all this doesn't seem right to me. I'm standing there with a sick feeling in my stomach when Tim strolls in, backpack hitched onto one shoulder, cardboard box in hand.
"Come on, kid. Let's get ghost before we have to deal with your ma or Clay. Word is they're on their way here. Being on the side of the morally superior is new to me, and I might screw up my lines."
Once we're outside, Tim throws his box of stuff and backpack into the back seat of the Jetta, then flips the passenger seat forward so I can climb in. "How bad is Clay?" I ask quietly. "I mean, is he a sleaze for real?"
"I did Google him," Tim admits. "Hell of an impressive resume for a guy who's only 36.
36? Mom's 46. So he's young. That doesn't necessarily mean he's bad. Mom listens to him like he's the one true frequency. But that doesn't mean he's bad either. But what's up with a double agent? This is a tiny race in Connecticut, not the Cold War.
How do you think he got so high up so fast?" I asked Tim. "I mean, really, 36? And if he's this big star in the Republican firmament,
Why is he taking the time to help out this dinky state senatorial race? That's got to be a blip on the radar.
I don't know, kid. He sure loves this stuff, though. The other day, this commercial ran for some race in Rhode Island, and Clay's all over it, calling the office up there to tell them what's wrong with their message. Maybe it's his idea of a vacation, helping out your ma.
He shoots a look at me, then smirks.
A vacation with a few extra benefits.
Would those be from my mom or that brunette you talked about? Tim folds himself into the driver's seat, turning the ignition and punching in the lighter simultaneously.
I don't know what's up with that. He's flirty with her, but those southern guys are like that. He certainly is all over your ma.
Ick. I know this, but don't want to think about it.
But luckily, it's not my problem anymore.
It doesn't go away because it's not your problem.
Yes, Mother. Listen, Clay cuts corners and is all about politics. That's working out just fine for him, Samantha. Why should he change? No incentive. No payback. In my brief shining moments as a political animal, that's one thing I've learned. It's all about incentive, payback, and how it all looks. Being a politician is a lot like being an alcoholic in denial.
Chapter 37. The day of the practice SATs, Nan and I biked to Stony Bay High to take the test. It's August, with heat shimmering off the sidewalks and the lazy whir of cicadas. But once we walk into the school, it's as though a switch has been flipped. The room is airless and smells like pencil shavings and industrial-strength disinfectant, all overlaid with too fruity perfume and sports deodorant, too many bodies. Stony Bay High is one of those low, endless, cookie-cutter brick schools, with ugly green-shaded windows, peeling gray paint on the doors, and curling red linoleum on the floors. It's a far cry from Hodges, which is built like a fortress, with battlements, stained-glass windows, and portcullises. It even has a drawbridge, because you never know when your prep school might be attacked by the Saxons. Public or private, there's that same school smell. So out of context today as I shift in my sticky seat, listening to the lazy roar of a lawnmower outside. "Remind me why I'm doing this again?" I ask Nan as she takes her place in the row in front of me, positioning her backpack at her feet. "Because practice makes perfect, or at least close enough to get you in the low 2000s, which will give us a shot at the college of our dreams, and because you're my best friend." She reaches into the pocket of her backpack and pulls out some chapstick, applying it to her slightly sunburned lips. As she does this, I can't help but notice that she's not only wearing her prized blue and white Columbia t-shirt, but also the cross she got for her communion, and a charm bracelet her Irish grandmother gave her, which has green and white enamel four-leaf clovers hanging from it. "Where's Buddha?" I ask. "Won't he feel left out? What about Zeus? A rabbit's foot?" She pretends to glare at me, lining up her 7 number 2 pencils in a precise row along the edge of her desk. "This is important. They say SATs aren't as big as they used to be, but you know that's not true. Can't be too careful. I'd burn sage, embrace Scientology, and wear one of those Kabbalah bracelets if I thought it would do me any good. I've got to get out of this town." No matter how often Nan says this, it never fails to give me a prickle of hurt. Ridiculous. It's not about me. The Mason House is nobody's idea of a refuge. Confirming this, she continues. "It's even worse now that Tim's only working at Garrett's. Mommy starts all her conversations with him like, 'Well, since you've made up your mind to be a loser all your life,' and then just ends up shaking her head and leaving the room." I sigh. "How's Tim dealing?" "I think he's up to 3 packs a day," Nan says. "Cigarettes and pixie sticks, but no sign of anything else. Yet." Her voice is resigned, clearly expecting to find evidence of worse at any moment. She starts, then falls silent as the side door of the classroom opens, and a small beige woman and a tall sandy-haired man come in, introducing themselves as our proctors for this practice SAT. The woman runs through the procedure in a monotone, while the man wanders through the room, checking our IDs and handing out blue notebooks. The air conditioning blasts to a higher level, nearly drowning out the beige woman's monotonous tone. Nan pulls a cardigan out of her backpack and scrabbles around to position a hoodie at the top, just in case. She sits back up, puts her elbows on the desk, leans her chin on her folded hands, and sighs. "I hate writing," she says. "I hate everything about it. Grammar usage, blech." Despite the light tan she always acquires in the late summer, she looks pale under her freckles, only her sunburned nose betraying the season. "You're the big writing star," I remind her. "You'll coast through this. Laszlo Literary Anthology, remember? The SATs are the minor leagues for you." The tall blonde man points extravagantly at the clock, and the beige woman says, "Shh," and begins the countdown as solemnly as if we are blasting off at Cape Canaveral, rather than taking a practice test. "In 10, 9, 8, I glance around the room. Everyone, evidently as driven as Nan, has their blue books and their pencils lined up in perfect symmetry. I look over again at Nan to see her adjust the sleeve of her sweatshirt in her backpack again, allowing me, from my vantage point to the left and back, to see the corner of her electronic dictionary peeking out from the light blue edge of her sweatshirt. She's staring at the clock, her mouth a grim line. Her pencil so tightly held in her fingers, it's a wonder it doesn't snap in half. Nan's left-handed. Her right hand rests on her thigh, in quick draw reach of her backpack. Suddenly, I get these pictures in my head of the way Nan sat in test after test I've taken alongside her, always with her backpack leaned to the side, her hoodie or sweater or whatever draping out. Memories click into place, like frames of a film slowly forwarding one after another, and I realize this is no isolated incident. Nanny, my always head of the class best friend, Nan, the star student, has been cheating for years. Good thing for me it's a practice test, because I can barely focus. All I can think about is what I saw, what I know for sure now. Nan doesn't need to cheat. I mean, nobody needs to cheat, but Nan's only ensuring a sure thing anyway. I mean, look at her essays. Her essays. Those files on Tim's computer that I looked at, that I blamed Tim for stealing. The realization freezes me in place. Minutes tick by before I finally pick up my pencil and try to concentrate on the exam. During break, I splash water on my face in the ugly aqua-tiled bathroom and try to figure out what to do. Tell the proctors? Out of the question. She's my best friend. But as I'm standing there staring into my own eyes, Nan comes up next to me, squirting antibacterial lotion on her hands and rubbing it up her arms as though scrubbing up for surgery. "I don't think it washes off," I say before I can think. "What?" "Guilt. Didn't work for Lady Macbeth, did it?" She turns white, then flushes, freckled translucent skin so quick to show both shades. She glances quickly around the bathroom, making sure we're alone. "I'm thinking about the future," she hisses. "My future. You may be happy hanging out at the garage with your handyman, eating Kraft macaroni and cheese, but I'm going to Columbia, Samantha. I'm going to get away from..." Her face crumples. "All of this." She waves her hand. "Everything." "Nan." I move toward her, arms outstretched. "You too. You're part of it all." Turning, she stalks out of the bathroom, stopping only to scoop up her backpack, from which the sweatshirt sleeve dangles uselessly. Did that really just happen? I feel sick. What just went wrong here? When did I become just another thing Nan wanted to escape? Chapter 38. The hotel ballroom stifling and overheated, like someone forgot to flip on the air conditioning. It would probably make me drowsy even if I hadn't gotten up at 5 this morning, restless, thinking about Nan, and gone to the ocean to swim. Not to mention that we're in Westfield, the other end of the state, a long, long drive from home, and I'm constricted in my formal blue linen dress. There's a big fountain in the middle of the room, and tables of finger sandwiches and buffet food set up around that. Out-of-season Christmas lights twinkle around statue reproductions of Venus rising from the waves and Michelangelo's David, looking as sulky and out of place as I feel at this fundraising rally. Mom makes her speech at the podium, flanked by Clay, and I struggle to stay conscious. "You must be so proud of your mother," people keep telling me, sloshing their fruity champagne cocktails over tiny plastic cups, and I repeat over and over again, "Oh, yes, I am. I am, yes." My seat's next to the podium, and as Mom's introduced, I can't help tipping my head against it, until she gives me a sharp jab with her foot, and I jerk back upright, willing my eyes open. Finally, she gives some sort of goodnight summary speech, and there's lots of cheering and go read. Clay rests his hand in the small of her back, propelling her as we edge out into the night, which isn't even really dark, kind of tea-colored since we're in the city.
"You're a wonder, Gracie. A 12-hour day and still looking so fine."
Mom gives a pleased laugh, then toys with her earring. "Honey?" She hesitates, then, "I just don't understand why that Marcy woman has to be at just about every event of mine."
"Was she there tonight?" Clay asks. "I didn't notice. And I've told you, they send her the same way we had Tim out counting the cars at Christopher's rallies, or Dorothy checking on his press conferences."
I know this is the brunette woman, but Clay doesn't sound like he's trying to pull one over on Mom. He sounds like he genuinely didn't realize Marcy was there.
"You gotta assess."
He pauses, laughs, then repeats carefully,
"Assess your opponent's strengths and weaknesses."
Clay trips a little on the pavement, and Mom gives a low laugh. "Easy, honey."
"Sorry, those stones kinda got away from me there."
They halt, leaning together in the darkness, swaying slightly.
"You better drive."
"Of course," Mom says. "Just give me those keys." Much chuckling while she searches for them in his jacket pockets. Oh, irk. And I just want to be home. Mom starts the car with a roar, vroom, and then giggles in surprise, as though cars never make that sound.
"Actually, sugar, better give me the keys," Clay tells her.
"I've got it," Mom says. "You had 4 glasses to my 3.
"Maybe," Clay says. "I might could have done."
"I just love your southern phrases," Mom murmurs. Time hazes. I slide down in my seat, stretching my legs out over an uncomfortable pile of Grace Reed signs and boxes of campaign flyers, tilting my eyes against the hard leather padding under the window. I watch the highway lights, my eyelids sinking, then the dimmer street lights as the roads get smaller and smaller, close to home.
"Take Shore Road," Clay tells her softly. "Less traffic. Nearly there now, Gracie."
The window glass is chilly against my cheek, the only cool thing in the warm car. Other headlights flash by for a while, then fade away. Finally, I see by the glint of the moon on the open water that we're passing McGuire Park. I remember being there with Jace, lying on the sun-warmed rock in the river. Then my lids slowly close, the hum of the engine like Mom's vacuum cleaner, a familiar lullaby. Blam! My nose smacks the seat in front of me, so hard that stars dazzle against my eyes and my ears ring. "Oh my God!" Mom says in a high, panicky voice, scarier than the sudden jolt. She slams on the brakes.
"Back up, Grace."
Clay's voice is level and firm.
"Mom? Mom, what happened?" "Oh my God," Mom repeats.
She always freaks out about dings in her paint job. There's a sudden whoosh of cool night air as Clay opens the passenger side door, climbs out. A second later, he's back.
"Grace, reverse, now. Nothing happened, Samantha. Go back to sleep."
I catch a flash of his profile, arm around Mom's neck, fingers in her hair, prodding her.
"Reverse and pull away, now,"
he repeats. The car jolts backward, jerks to a halt.
"Grace, pull it together."
The car revs forward and to the left.
Just get us back home.
Mom? It's nothing, sweetheart. Go to sleep. Hit a little bump in the road. Go back to sleep, Mom calls, her voice sharp. And I do. She might still be talking, but I'm just so tired. When Tracy and I were younger, Mom sometimes used to drive us down to Florida for winter vacation instead of flying. She liked to stop in Manhattan, in Washington, in Atlanta, stay in bed and breakfasts, poke around antique stores along the way. I was always so impatient to get to the sand and the dolphins that I tried to sleep every single hour we were in the car. I feel like that now. I sink into soft blackness so absolute I can barely drag myself out when Mom says, "Samantha, we're home. Go on to bed." She jiggles my arm, roughly enough that it hurts, and I drag myself upstairs, collapse on my mattress, too weary to take off my dress or dive under the covers. I just embrace nothingness. My cell buzzes insistently. I shoved it under my pillow as usual. Now I hunt for it half asleep, my fingers clutching and closing on bunches of the sheets, while the buzzing goes on and on and on, relentless. Finally, I locate it.
Sam?
Jace's voice, hoarse, almost unrecognizable.
Sam?
Hmm?
Samantha?
His voice is loud, jarring. I jerk the cell away from my ear.
What? Jace?
Sam, we need you. Can you come over?
I crawl across the bed, blearily check my digital clock. 1:16 a.m.
What? Now?
Now. Please, can you come now?
I haul myself out of bed, yank off my dress, pull on shorts and a t-shirt, flip-flops, climb out the window, down the trellis. I glance quickly back at the house, but Mom's bedroom lights are off, so I run through the light rain across the grass to the garrets. Where all the lights, the driveway, porch, kitchen lights, blaze. So out of the ordinary at this time of night that I stumbled to a halt in the driveway.
Samantha?
Andy's voice calls from the kitchen door.
Is that you? Jace said you'd come.
She's silhouetted in the doorway, surrounded by smaller shadows. Duff, Harry, George, Patsy, in Andy's arms. At this hour... What's going on?
Daddy.
Andy's holding back tears.
Something happened to Daddy. Mom got a call.
Her face crumples.
She went to the hospital with Alice.
She throws herself into my arms.
Jace went too. He said you'd be here to take care of us.
Okay. Okay. Let's go inside, I say. Andy's pulled back, taking deep breaths, trying to get hold of herself. The little ones watch, wide-eyed and bewildered. The frozen expression on George's face is one of the hardest things I've ever had to look at. All his imagined disasters, and he never imagined this. Chapter 39. In the light of the kitchen, all the children are blinking, sleepy and disoriented. I try to think what Mrs. Garrett would do to rally everyone, and can only come up with making popcorn. So I do that. And hot chocolate, even though the air, despite the rain, is stifling as an electric blanket. George perches on the counter next to me as I stir chocolate powder into milk.
"Mommy puts the chocolate in first,"
he reproves, squinting at me in the brightness of the overhead light. This is, no doubt, a good idea, as I'm stuck with grainy lumps of powder I'm trying to mash against the side of the pot. Mom makes hot cocoa with some fancy chocolate shavings from Ghirardelli's in San Francisco. They melt more easily.
"We don't have any whipped cream,"
Harry's glum.
"There's no point in hot chocolate without whipped cream." "There's a point if there are marshmallows,"
George insists.
"Boob!"
Patsy calls mournfully from the circle of Andy's arms.
"Well, boob!"
"What if Daddy's dead and they aren't telling us?" interjects Andy. George begins to cry. When I pick him up, he snuggles his head against my shoulder, warm tears slipping on my bare skin. I'm reminded for a second of Nan crying in my arms, all defenses down, and how she's raised her shield so completely now. What could have happened to fit, strong Mr. Garrett? A heart attack? A stroke? A brain aneurysm?
"He's not dead," Duff says stoutly. "When you're dead, policemen come to your door. I've seen it on TV."
Harry runs over to whip open the porch door.
"No policeman," he calls back. "But, hi, Tim."
"Hi, kiddo."
Tim shoulders his way into the room, hair soggy, wetness shining on his windbreaker.
"Jace called me, Samantha. You go to the hospital. I'll hang here."
He flips me the keys to the Jetta.
"Go,"
he repeats. "I can't drive."
"Oh, for fuck's sake, okay."
He turns to Andy.
"I'll take her to the hospital and then be back to help you, do whatever, except change diapers."
He jabs his index finger at Patsy.
"Don't you dare poop."
"Poop,"
Patsy says in a small, subdued voice. Before we get to the ER, Tim insists on skidding to a halt at a gas-and-go to buy cigarettes, scrabbling in his pockets for cash. "We don't have time for this," I hiss. "Plus, it's bad for your lungs."
"Got 10 bucks?
He rejoins.
"My lungs are the least of our problems at the moment."
I shove a handful of bills at him. Once he's gotten his fix, we head off again toward the hospital. There's no sign of Mrs. Garrett or Alice, but Jace is sitting in one of the ugly orange plastic bucket seats in the waiting room, hunched over, heels of his hands against his forehead. Tim gives me an unnecessarily hard shove and takes off. I slip into the seat next to Jace. He doesn't move, either not noticing or not caring that there's someone next to him. I put my hand on his back. His arms drop and he turns to look at me. His eyes are full of tears. Then he wraps himself tight around me, and I wrap around him. There we are for a long time, not saying a word. After a while, Jace stands up, goes over to the water fountain, splashes water on his face, comes back over, and puts his cold, wet hands on my cheeks. We still haven't said anything. A door bangs. Alice. "Head injury," she tells Jace grimly. "He's still unconscious. Maybe a subdural hematoma. They really can't tell how serious right now, just containing. There's a lot of swelling. Definitely a pelvic fracture, bad break. Some ribs, that's not a big deal. It's the brain stuff we won't know about for a while."
"Hell, hell," Jace says. "Alice."
"I know," she says. "I don't get it. Why was he walking on Shore Road so late? There aren't any meetings out there. Not usually." Shore Road. Shore Road. It's like some awful fog clears, and I can see Mom driving home from Westfield, taking the uncrowded route along the river. McGuire Park. By the river. Shore Road. "I've got to get back in there," Alice tells us. "I'll be out when I know more." I've never spent any time in hospitals. The waiting room fills up with people who appear desperately sick, and people who seem to be as calm as though they are waiting at a bus stop to travel on to a destination they don't really care about. The small hand of the clock moves from 2 to 3 to 4. Some of the bus stop people get called in before the people who look as though their time on Earth is measured in milliseconds. Jace and I sit there as the monitors murmur. "Dr. Rodriguez, paging Dr. Rodriguez. Dr. Wilcox, code blue, Dr. Wilcox." At first I lean on Jace's shoulder, then he bows his head, and it dips lower and lower. By the time Alice returns, his head is in my lap, and I'm nodding over his curls. She shakes me forcefully, startling me back from some confused dream about Shore Road, to this room with fluorescent lights, and the weight of Jace in my lap, and the catastrophe of everything. "Mom says you two should go on home." Alice pauses to swig from the bottle of Coke in her hand, then holds it against her temple. "He's got to open the store. We can't stay shut for a day, so he needs a few hours' sleep." What? Jace jolts awake.
Huh?
He usually seems older than me, but now his hair a mess and his drowsy green eyes hazy, he looks so young.
Alice's eyes meet mine, hers imperative, saying, take care of him, without uttering a word.
Go home. We don't know anything yet.
Alice polishes off her Coke in a few long swallows and arcs it into the blue plastic recycling bin, a perfect basket. The light rain is still falling when Jace and I go out to the van, droplets of soft mist. Jace tips his head to the sky, which is clouded over, impossible to see the stars. We don't say anything on the drive home, but he reaches out one hand from the steering wheel, tangling it with mine, holding on so tightly it almost hurts. The Garrett's house is still lit like a birthday cake when we pull into the driveway.
They can't all be awake still, Jace mutters.
They were pretty scared, I say, wondering how much chaos there'll be when we get in. Leaving Tim in charge? Perhaps not the best idea. But the house is silent. The kitchen looks as though an invading army came hungry and left swiftly. Cartons of ice cream, bags of chips and cereal boxes and bowls and plates stacked everywhere, but no one stirring.
You could have mentioned that this kid never sleeps,
Tim calls from the living room. We go in to find him slumped in the easy chair next to the pulled-out sofa bed. Andy's sprawled out on the bed, long tan legs in a V, George gathered in her arms. Duff, still in his clothes, lies across the bottom, Harry curled in a ball on the pillow under Andy's outstretched leg. Safety, as much as could be found, must have lain in numbers. Patsy's fingering Tim's nose and pulling on his bottom lip, her eyes wide blue open.
Sorry, man, Jace says. She's usually good to go at bedtime. Do you have any idea how many times I've read, if you give a mouse a cookie to this kid? That is one fucked up story. How is that a book for babies?
Jace laughs.
I thought it was about babysitting. Hell no, it's addiction. That friggin' mouse is never satisfied. You give him one thing, he wants something else, and then he asks for more and on and on and on. Fucked up. Patsy liked it, though, 50,000 times.
Tim yawns, and Patsy snuggles more comfortably onto his chest, grabbing a handful of shirt.
So, what's doing?
We tell him what we know. Nothing. Then put the baby in her crib. She glowers, angry and bewildered for a moment, then grabs her 5 pacifiers, closes her eyes with a look of fierce concentration, and falls very deeply asleep.
See you at the store, dude. I'll open up. Night, Samantha.
Tim heads out into the dark. Jace and I stand in the doorway for a few minutes, watching Tim's headlights light up, the Jetta backing out of the driveway. Then the silence gapes between us.
What if Dad's got brain damage, Sam? A head injury? What if he's in a coma? What if he never wakes up?
We don't know how serious it is yet, I say. It can't be bad. Please don't let it be bad. Jace bends over, pulling off a sock.
His head, Sam? No way that's good. Mom and Dad don't have health insurance for themselves. Just for us kids.
I shut my eyes, rubbing my forehead as though that'll erase those words.
They dropped it last spring, Jace tells me softly. I heard them talking. They said only for a few months. They were both healthy, young enough, nothing pre-existing. It wasn't a big deal.
He drops his second sneaker with a clunk, adding under his breath,
it is now.
I swallow, shaking my head, nothing to say for consolation, for anything, really. Straightening, he reaches a hand for me, drawing me toward the stairs. His room's gently lit by the heat lamp in Voldemort's cage, a faint red glow that barely illuminates the other cages and nests, redolent with the earthy plant smell and the tang of the clean sawdust in the animal cages, scored by the soft whirring noise of the hamster wheel. He turns on his bedside light, takes his cell phone out of his back pocket, turns up the volume on the ringer, drops it on the bedside table. He moves Mazda, the cat, who is sprawled in the middle of the bed with her paws in the air, to the bottom. He goes over to his bureau,
pulls out a white t-shirt and hands it to me.
Sam,
he whispers, turning to me. A beautiful, bewildered boy. I sigh into his neck, dropping the shirt to the floor as Jace's hand slipped down the bend of my waist, pulling me close enough that his heartbeat sounds against mine. What I'm imagining is true, cannot possibly be the truth. So I hold on to Jace and try to pour all my love and any strength I have into him, through my lips and my arms and my body. I push away that whisper of Shore Road, and Mom saying, "Oh my God," and Clay's steady voice, and that awful thump. I fold them up, pack them away, wrap them in bubble wrap and duct tape. We've been urgent together, in a hurry to feel all we can feel, but never like this, never so frantic. He's pulling at my shirt, and I'm gliding my palms up his smooth sides, feeling his muscles twitch with tension and response, his lips warm on my throat, my fingers in his hair. A little desperate, and somehow a relief, some sense of the strength of life in this still night. Afterward, Jace ducks his head, bending it heavily against my shoulder, breathing hard. We say nothing for a while. Then,
"Do I need to apologize?"
he asks.
I don't know why I... It helped, but...
I slide my finger slowly to his lips. No, don't. Don't. It helped me, too. We stay there for a long time, our heartbeats edging gradually back to normal, sweat drying on our skin, our breaths intermingling. Finally, without words, we climb into Jace's bed. He urges my head to his chest gently, warm hand against my neck. In no time his breathing evens out, but I lie awake, staring at the ceiling. Mom, what did you do? Chapter 40.
Jace, honey? Jace!
Mrs. Garrett's voice is loud outside the hushed room. She rattles the doorknob slightly, but he'd locked it so it doesn't open. He springs up, at the door in a flash, his tall body silhouetted against the light, unlocking, but then opening it as little as possible.
"Is Dad? What's happening?"
His voice cracks.
"He's stable. They did an emergency procedure, drilled something called a burr hole to relieve pressure in his skull. Alice says that's standard. I just came home to change clothes and pump for Patsy. Joel's there. We really can't tell much until he wakes up."
Her voice is strong but full of tears.
"Sure you can take care of the store today?"
"I'm on it, Mom."
"Alice is going to stay with me to interpret the medical ease. Joel has to go to work, but he'll be back tonight. Can you get Tim to help you out? I know it's not his day, but..."
Moving out into the hall, he bends to hug her. I always think of Mrs. Garrett as tall. With a shock, I realize she's as small as me against her lanky son.
"It'll be fine. We'll work it out. Tim already said he'd open up." Tell Dad I love him. Bring something to read to him. The Perfect Storm book? He's been wanting to read that one forever. It's in his truck."
"Samantha, can you stay with the kids?"
Mrs. Garrett calls. Even in the dim light, I see him flush.
"Sam was just..."
He trails off. Poor Jace. What can he say? Dropping by? Helping me feed the animals?
"It's okay," she says quickly. "Can you stay, Sam?"
"I'll be here," I call. The day passes in a blur. I do the things I do when babysitting for the Garretts, but they don't work the way they're supposed to. I've never had Patsy for more than a few hours, and it's a toss-up which she hates more, the bottle or me. Mrs. Garrett calls at 10, apologizing. She can't come home to nurse her, and there's some breast milk in the freezer. Patsy won't have any of that. She bats the bottle away, wailing. By 2 in the afternoon, she's a red-faced, sobbing, sweaty mess. I know from the note of hysteria in her cry how tired she is, but she won't nap. When I put her in the crib, she throws all the stuffed animals out of it in a clear protest. George doesn't leave my side. He recites facts to me in a hushed, tense tone, clutching my arm to make sure I pay attention, crying easily. Harry systematically works his way through the things he's not supposed to do, hitting George and Duff, throwing an entire roll of toilet paper in the toilet to see what happens, taking a tube of cookie dough out of the refrigerator and starting to eat it with his fingers. By the time Jace comes in at 5, I'm inches away from lying down on the rug next to Patsy and drumming my heels, too. But I'm glad I'm busy, because it almost, not quite, but almost, shuts down the line of thoughts that run through my mind like a news crawl at the bottom of a TV screen. This can't have anything to do with Mom. It can't. There's no way. Jace looks so drained and I pull myself together, ask how sales went, if he's heard more from the hospital.
More nothing, he says, unlacing one sneaker and tossing it into the mudroom. He's stable. There's no change. I don't even know what stable's supposed to mean. He's been hit by a car and had a hole drilled in his skull. Stable is what you say when everything is the same, but nothing's the same here. He throws his second sneaker hard against the wall, leaving a black smudge. The noise startles Patsy in my arms, and she starts wailing again. Jace looks at her, then reaches out his arms, cuddles her in, his tan skin stark against her soft, pale arms.
I'm guessing your day sucked too, Sam.
Not the same way. Patsy grabs a fistful of his t-shirt and tries to put it in her mouth.
Poor baby,
Jace says softly into Patsy's neck. Alice comes home soon after this, bringing pizza and more no news wrapped in medical jargon. They had to do the burr hole to relieve intracranial pressure, Jace. Swelling of the brain is always a concern when there's a head injury, and it seems as though he landed right on his head. But patients usually recover from that with no long-term sequelae, consequences, as long as there isn't additional trauma we don't know about yet. Jace shakes his head, biting his lip and turning away as the younger kids tumble into the kitchen, lured by the smell of pizza and the sound of older people who can make sense of everything.
I biked out to Shore Road this afternoon,
Duff offers,
looking for clues. Nothing.
This isn't CSI, Duff. Alice's voice is sharper than the wheel she's using to slice pizza.
It's a mystery, though. Someone hit Dad and just drove away. I thought maybe I'd see skid marks and we could ID the tires, or broken bits of plastic from a headlight or something. Then maybe we could match it to a certain type of car and...
Get nowhere, Alice says. Whoever hit Dad is long gone.
Most hit-and-run drivers are never identified, admits Duff. I read that online, too.
I shut my eyes as a shameful wave of relief rolls through me. Jace walks over to the screen door, clenching and unclenching his fists.
Jesus, how could someone do that? What kind of a person would? Hit someone, hit another human being with their car, and just keep on going.
I feel sick. Maybe they didn't know they'd hit someone.
Impossible.
His voice is harder, tougher than I've ever heard it.
When you're driving, you know when you hit a rough patch of gravel, an old piece of tire, a fast food container, a dead squirrel. No way could you hit a 170-pound man and not notice.
Maybe the person who hit him was the person he was meeting up with,
Duff speculates.
Maybe Dad is involved in some top-secret business and...
Duff, this is not Spy Kids. This is real life. Our life. Alice shoves a paper plate violently toward her younger brother. Duff's face flushes, tears flooding his eyes. He swallows, looking down at his slice.
I'm just trying to help.
Jace moves behind him, squeezing his shoulder.
We know. Thanks, Duffy, we know.
The little kids dig in, their appetites intact, despite everything.
Maybe Dad's in the mob,
Duff speculates a little while later, eyes dry now, mouth full.
And he was about to blow the whistle on the whole thing and...
Shut the heck up, Duff! Daddy's not in the mob! He's not even Italian!
Andy shouts.
There's a Chinese mob and a...
Knock it off! You're just being stupid and annoying on purpose!
Now Andy bursts into tears.
Guys, Jace begins.
Be quiet now, Alice says in a flat voice so deadly everyone.